Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the September 20th, 2016 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please, if you have electronic devices, cell phones, or other things, please silence them. That goes for legislators as well. If there's an emergency, there are exits to my right in the back of the room and to my left in the front of the room. If, in case of a fire, please don't use the elevator. Would you stand with me for the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. May we have the roll call of members, please?
Mr. Dennis?
I am here.
Mr. John?
Here.
Ms. Kellis?
Here.
Ms. Keeper?
Present.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
I am here.
Mr. Morey?
Here.
Ms. Robertson has asked to be excused. Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Cutting out there, Kathy. I am here.
Ms. Chalk? Ms. Chalk?
I'm here.
Thanks. Mr. Lane?
Here.
13 members present?
We have quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I'm very pleased tonight to say that we're going to recognize the service of some of our employees. And we have some of them who are here with us tonight, other ones that couldn't be here tonight. I'm going to read the list, and I'm going to come back to the ones that are here tonight. They are Jackie Washington for 8 years, Gwendolyn Wilkinson for 22 years, Linda Halstead for 26 years, Mary Monkman for 11, Yvonne Carroll for 17, Lisa Seagard for 26, Sharon Reagan for 20, Susan Rolstad for 18 years, Michael Searles for 18 years, Teresa Lisco for 28 years, and Barbara O'Brien in facilities for 27. I didn't read the departments, I should have. Jackie Washington is in mental health. Gwen Wilkinson, of course, is our district attorney, has been. Linda Halstead in finance, Mary Monkman in public health, Yvonne Carroll in mental health, Lisa Seagard in sheriff's office, Sharon Reagan, finance office, Susan Rolstead in mental health, Michael Searles in the sheriff's office, and Teresa Lidsko, public health, and, of course, Barbara O'Brien in facilities. I believe we have Jackie Washington, Gwendolyn Wilkinson, and Linda Halstead. I wonder if they might come up. Is there anybody else that's come in? I haven't heard about them.
I don't think Jackie's here.
Sorry?
I don't think Jackie's here.
Okay, we have at least two then. We have obviously Gwen, and we have Linda.
Okay. All right, yay.
We're very pleased to have you here tonight and recognize the 8 years of service, and we have a plaque for you tonight.
26 or 26.
I want to thank everybody. I've enjoyed my almost 27 years actually with the county. I started out as a typist in 1990 and I've worked my way up to a payroll coordinator. I've enjoyed all the people I've dealt with over the years and the friends I've made and the family at work. And I'm going to miss everybody, but I will actually be working through February 10th for training my replacement. So if you have any questions still, feel free to call. Thank you very much.
Jackie Washington for 8 years. We have a certificate for you.
Thank you.
From the citizens of Tompkins County. If you'd like to say anything, please have a speech.
It's been a pleasure to work for the county, to work at Tompkins County Mental Health. I was able to impact a lot of people and to meet some really great people, and it gave me the opportunity to work on my desire, which is helping people to help themselves. And so it's just been a real blessing for me. So thank you.
And of course, Gwen Wilkinson.
Woo-hoo.
Gwen for 22 years. We're going to miss you, Gwen. We're going to miss all of these folks.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I want to thank all of you guys. I've known some of you for a very long time and some of you for a very short time. You have been wonderful mentors and colleagues, and it's been a pleasure to work with you in my capacity as district attorney. And I'm looking forward to working with you in the future on some of the other projects that we've got going on. So if any of you survive the budget process, I will see you in the fall. Thank you very much.
Special thanks to Jackie Thomas for coordinating all this from personnel. I don't think we have an executive session tonight. Is that correct, Joe and Jonathan?
That's correct.
Excuse me, Mike. Did we do the pledge?
Yes, we did.
I just spaced that out. I'm sorry.
You want to do it again?
That's fine. Once is quite enough.
Make sure.
Let's go to privilege of the floor for the public. This is an opportunity for any person from the public to speak for up to 3 minutes to our legislature about any topic. We ask if you want to speak to please pass up a blue card. Do we have any at this point? We don't have any blue cards at this point. Is there anyone out there who would like to speak that hasn't signed a card? I'm not seeing any, so we'll move then right to privilege of the floor for municipal officials. And I know Mike Murphy is here. He's a trustee from the village of Dryden. Mike, would you come up to a microphone? Welcome. I see George McGonigal in the back, too. We'll get you next, George.
The mic's not on.
No?
There.
Oh,
there
I'm maybe not close enough. I'm sorry. Okay. The village of Dryden is concerned about one of your proposals. It was very kind of you to send it out to us, but it was to limit the amount of fees that we could add to our taxes that we send to the county at the end of the year. And for many villages, that's probably no problem. But we have a water and sewer system, and we have been making use of the fact that people will owe us money, and we tax it, we add it onto our tax bill to them. And if they don't pay their tax bill, we've been passing it on to you. This year, at this point in time, we have $59,000 worth of tax bills that if they don't pay will just oh, okay.
It up more.
Mike, feel free to come to the seat at the end and speak at that microphone, or Mike Siegel will bring you one.
Hello. Okay. Hopefully I get back to where I was talking about. Anyway, there's $59,000 at this point in time, and unfortunately we didn't have enough time until we decided to talk to you to look at last year. But of the $59,000, almost $17,000 is water and sewer that you came out with a proposal that fees, and we interpreted that to be a fee that we were adding on to our taxes that we were passing on to you. And the $500 fee, only one of 15 would make that cutoff. And I had heard the proposal that maybe $1,000, but we have nine that wouldn't make that cutoff. And it's a real hardship for us to have this money uncollected. So that's why you've been able to let us pass on our regular taxes. This also would be a hardship to do. We can't really foreclose on the property. And it's, if there's somebody from the public health department, I tried to contact them today. The top two people were out of town. But our understanding is that even though we have in our rules or regulations that we can shut off water, but not sure the health department would allow us to shut it off. So if we can't shut it off, and we can't foreclose on the property, the only thing is a costly suit. And then if they're unwilling to pay, we're kind of trouble. Whereas you have the ability to take the taxes, collect them from them, be reimbursed by it, or if not, after I believe it's 3 years and all good due diligence to get them to pay, you can foreclose on the property and auction it and get it back. So what we're asking is that we not use a $500 limit or a $1,000 limit, because we had one that's $4,000. We have three that are $1,800, that we use a percentage. We know that you don't want to be stuck for everything, but a percentage of the fees couldn't exceed 20 or 25% of the value of the property. Something along that lines would give us some flexibility, and we wouldn't say, oh, this one's just a little bit over. What are we going to do? Can we do the first 2,000 of it, and the other 2,000 we can't. So I guess what I'm asking is that you relook at it and look at it from the prospect of the villages that do have water and sewer, and this has been our way of collecting the money when they are unwilling to pay. We add it to our village taxes, and then if they do not pay that, it's passed on to Tompkins County. I guess that's my main point. I will, with Reba Taylor, the mayor, try to get you something in writing that's a little clearer, a little more intelligent. But we decided that we needed to get somebody down here. We first discussed it in the meeting on Thursday, and it kind of went around, and we finally said, hey, we got to do something. They asked us, so here we are. I guess that's it, unless there's questions.
Questions for Mike. Carol Chalk.
Yeah, when you say that, thanks for coming out, by the way. When you say it's passed on to Tompkins County, you're saying the cost is passed on to Tompkins County, the collection is passed on, or the ability to foreclose?
Well, we can't foreclose. Only you can foreclose the way the law is set up. The way it's set up now is that when the villages cannot collect the property taxes, if they become delinquent, we pass them on to Tompkins County, and they reimburse us for the amount of money that was not paid in taxes. Say it's $1,000. They reimburse us at the end of the year, and then they add it to their tax rolls. And the people either pay the taxes, or after 3 years of not paying their county taxes, their school taxes, and the village tax, the town and the village don't have the ability to foreclose, but the county does, and they can foreclose on the property and put it up to auction and then recoup all the taxes that was owed to them and to the village and to the town. But we passed it on because we don't have the financial ability to carry the taxes on, and we don't have the ability to really force a collection like you do with foreclosure.
Okay, and then can I follow up?
Yeah, I just point out we do the same thing with the school districts.
Okay, well, I just want to understand that what the implications for the taxpayers of the county from your perspective, because when you say they, it's we.
Yeah, it's me too.
Yeah. So we have the ability then to foreclose. We get paid, and then the town or village gets paid, and then whatever might still be owed to the bank.
No, that's not quite it. Maybe I wasn't clear. What it is it's been going on for a number of years. I don't know when it started, but it has been a policy that we could pass on the taxes. And they accepted the fees, which water and sewer is a fee. It's not a tax. But the village adds it to their taxes if you don't pay your fees. And the county has in the past taken any unpaid tax bills from the village, from a school, or from a town, and reimbursed them at the point that they took over ownership of these delinquent taxes. They added them to the county taxes, and they have the ability, if the person does not pay his county taxes, at some point, 3 years, and with due diligence trying to get it paid, they can foreclose on the property to collect the money by putting it to auction. We do not have that ability. So it has been the past practice, but somebody looked at it and for some reason decided, well, maybe we should cut back on what we can do in fees or we allow it. And they came up with a $500 number. And our person talked to the gentleman who was involved in it. And he said, well, we could raise it to $1,000. But $1,000 really wouldn't help us either. And I will try to contact the other municipalities or villages, I should say, that have water and sewer. If your village does not provide water and sewer, then this is not an issue. The only issue you have is somebody doesn't pay my taxes. This new proposal you have does not affect that municipality. They would just pass their taxes on, and you would say fine. But in our village, somebody owes $6,000 in taxes, $4,000 is water bill. We cannot do anything about it in regards to foreclosure to collect. So in the past, we've always been able to pass it on to you. It's added in with the taxes because we added it into our taxes. And for some reason, somebody's deciding that, well, maybe we should cut back. And I can understand that. That's why I proposed a limit. You know, if we had a house that was only worth $60,000 and they owed $30,000 or $40,000, you wouldn't really want to take on that liability. But most of ours are smaller and not up to that range, but our highest was $4,000. If we couldn't pass it on, there would be about $16,000, $17,000 we'd have to carry this year and next year, and we don't know when we'd get paid. And, you know, that's 1% of our budget, and soon it could be 2 or 3%. And it is a small, very miserable part of the town, not town, the county's budget. And they have in the past been providing this service, which we really appreciate, just the tax, but they've also provided the fees, which was I'm talking about today in the past, and we would appreciate it if they would continue that. Did that answer your question, or you're still confused?
That answered my question.
Thank you.
Yeah, there might be concerned about setting a limit or whatever else.
I would point out that I think probably, Dan, you can speak to this better than I, but some of the concern is not only water and sewer bills, but there are other things that can be added to the tax rolls, not in various municipalities. For example, an abandoned building could have demolition costs that could get pretty pricey. So that's what I think the object here is to protect the county taxpayers also.
You're right. Now, I agree that they should be protected, but the cost of a demolition and lowering the value of the property is slightly different than our water sewer issue, and we would like more flexibility in passing that on like we had in the past.
Rich John.
What would be the municipality's position if the approach was to have the local municipality cover the cost if the ultimate sale didn't reimburse the county for the taxes and user fees?
That would make sense to me, you know, in the sense that you shouldn't be left holding the bag. So, but it would have to be split with the different municipalities that had passed on, whether it be the school or the town, but it would only be fair to share it. But I can't speak for my board. I can only speak from my perspective that that would seem fair. That's why I suggested that we put a limit on how much the fees could be in relationship to the value of the property, because we wouldn't want the fees and the taxes to exceed what the property's worth, because then you'd definitely be holding the bag even if you sold the property for the difference.
Dan Klein.
What?
Dan, want
to speak. Chair. That's my intention to pull this from the agenda tonight, send it back to the Government Operations Committee. I think that'll be a better venue to have this discussion, and we'll find a solution to this.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time tonight.
Thank you for coming tonight, Mike. We appreciate it. We don't often have someone from the village of Dryden. George McGonigal is here from the city of Ithaca. He's a councilman.
Good evening. I'm actually standing in for Duxin Nguyen, who normally comes the second meeting of the month, and I apologize for missing the first meeting of the month. It's a well-known fact that I like to brag.
No.
So tonight I'd like to brag about Duck. Duck was involved this past month in a competition through his employment. A team of his coworkers went off to this competition that involves computer stuff, for lack of a better term. And they came in second place in a national competition and won for his company $1 million, which I think is pretty impressive. And I hope he gets a good bonus this year and that we all get invited to the party. So, but I'm very proud of Duck, as is the city. So I just will report about our last council meeting. We did quite a few things. We passed a resolution for diversity inclusion requirements for the City of Ithaca's CTAP program. They're quite specific and they're quite lengthy, so I won't go into all the details unless you have questions. We voted to provide money to expand the Alex Haley waiting pool, which is a good thing. We passed a resolution that was filed by my First Ward Council colleague, Cynthia Brock, which was the Equal Access to Abortion Coverage in Health Insurance Act. That passed unanimously. It's kind of a counter to the Hyde Amendment of, I think, the mid-70s, which made public funds for abortion services not available, and is still currently the law. Also, we agreed to spend $150,000 to study a major study that would look at perhaps selling some city property and relocating and combining different departments under one roof. That's going to be a major study. That's what we did at our council meeting. And then last week, the planning committee met and talked primarily about the future of the Carpenter Business Park, which was bought last year by the McGuire family of dealerships. And they have presented a plan about what they want to do on that land. And at the planning committee meeting, there was public hearing about that subject, which was the biggest crowd I've ever seen in City Hall. And there were varying views. There's quite a bit of concern about McGuire's plans from, I would say, a large portion of the community that lives nearby. There were many McGuire employees and also local people who spoke in favor of the project and made some very good points. Some things were said that were surprising in that they were didn't seem to have a full grasp of what this property is. But that's part of the public process. So that nothing was decided. The discussion is going to continue next month at the planning committee, and eventually it will reach common council because earlier this year council passed an a requirement that this prop, that the whole West End, basically, and the waterfront is subject to a PUD, and so that council will decide whether a project is suitable according to the comprehensive plan and other things. Any questions?
Questions. Jim Dennis.
George, the first thing you said, the city adopted a new CTAP policy, and they made an amendment to the CTAP policy.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
For city projects. Projects
I understand.
In the city.
I understand.
Julie Kiefer.
You said you would not go into any details about that latter topic unless you were asked, so I'd like to ask for a little information about what was passed for CTAP, for city projects.
The crux of the matter was diversity and inclusion requirements. So this would include diversity according to race, gender, sexual orientation, and for projects that have one main end user, they're going to like be like a hotel or something that has one end user, there'd be specific requirements about their employment practices. Would they need to follow these requirements? And part of it is it's not just a list of numbers, but being involved in planning what's best for this project, and also follow up as to how well these requirements have been instituted. And the details are on the city website.
Thank you.
Carol?
Hi. Thanks for coming, by the way. It's, you know, it's always
I enjoy
really great to keep
meetings.
The communication open. And anything that we ask you, if you're not ready to give us an update, you know, just say that. Can you say anything further about water, both you know, from the city's perspective, or what are you hearing from residents about water quality issues
and
then progress
question.
About the plant?
I should have mentioned that. Thank you. Well, we had a rough summer. There was a number of factors that came together and made some people's water look like black coffee. Literally, there was some samples that came in looking like black coffee. We did not charge people extra for that water. But it was a combination of factors. The drought was the main factor. And because there was so little rainwater, most of the water that was coming down Six Mile Creek was spring-fed water, and it was going through the rocks, and there's magnesium and another element that I forget, but
iron.
Both iron. Both changed the color of the water, put some color in the water, and the fact that our water treatment plant is coming online and all the kinks weren't necessarily worked out, the combination of those two factors basically caused some varying degrees of color in the water, from light brown to this dark brown, which was rare. I have to say that I'm very proud of our Department of Public Works for working very hard and very long hours to address this issue. And I think it's pretty much gone away now. And then there was a big busted water main down on Meadow Street that caused the browning of the water in certain neighborhoods after we thought everything was dealt with. But it was a rough summer for city water.
And the plant?
Pardon me?
The plant, when do you expect the plant to be fully functional, the new one?
It's real close now. I don't know the answer to that question specifically, though.
Thank you.
But we're very close.
Peter Stein.
Colored water from red to black doesn't sound very good. But one wonders, at least I wonder, how serious a threat did it mean for people who drank that water?
I may be sticking my neck in a noose, but I will say it wasn't a health threat.
It was not.
It was not. It wasn't like lead or anything like that. It wrecked a few dainties in the delicate cycle. I know that. And it also caused some people's water bills to be unduly high. And for those residents who, like if they were flushing a hydrant near their house or they had a high water bill, they can actually go to the Department of, or the Board of Public Works and ask for some relief to their water bill. But they have to do it. They have to initiate the process.
Anyone else? George, thank you, as usual, for coming.
One more thing. I'd just like to thank the county board for pitching in with the Gorge Ranger project this year. Thanks to you, we had more Gorge Rangers, and they really do a good job, and it's an ongoing problem, and we're trying to find a balance about how we enforce the regulations and what the regulations are, but the Gorge Rangers are really a beneficial thing for the public and for the city. And I just want to thank you for helping to fund that.
You're welcome. It's a good intermunicipal project. Don't see any other municipal officials. So we'll move to privilege of the floor for legislators. They're getting their hands up quickly here. I have Glenn Morey first, then Jim Dennis, then Anna Kellis.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. On Friday, I participated in a tour of five farms around Tompkins County. It was sponsored by the Tompkins County Agricultural and Farmland Protection Board. This is coordinated by Debbie Teeter of Cooperative Extension. Our stops included Walnut Ridge, which is the old Hardy Farm, and Baker's Acres in Lansing, the Scheffler Farm and Carey Farm in Groton, and the Ithac Organics in Dryden. We were also joined by New Visions Life Sciences Program and their FFA advisor, Michelle Klein. This is a program at Cornell University for 14 high school students. New Vision gives the students an opportunity to explore fields in applied science research. And many of these young people are aspiring veterinarians, plant breeders, and scientists. We're also joined by another group from TST BOCES, Animal Science Program, and their teacher, Matita Lefevre. The Animal Science Program at BOCES prepares students in a wide range of animal care. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Debbie Teeter for coordinating this tour. It was very rewarding, and this gave me a good understanding of the hardships that all the agricultural community has on a daily basis.
Use your microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. It gives me a good opportunity and understanding the hardships of the agricultural community of our areas. So thank you.
Thank you, Glenn. Jim?
Thank you, Mike. Just a small mention. When Peter asked the question to George about the water, the Tompkins County Health Department was involved with all that throughout the whole process. So it was not the city making a determination whether the water was good or bad. They were having help from us. And, you know, I think people have to understand that, you know, we're in a partnership when it comes to those kinds of things. with all the municipalities. What I wanted to speak about was Coach Richie Moran. There was a story in the Ithaca Times a week ago that Coach Moran was honored in Baltimore by one of his team participants in the 1970s, a guy named Brooks Bradley, who played on the 1971 national championship lacrosse team. In the 70s, Cornell won three times, 75, 76. And the U.S. Lacrosse Foundation recently moved to a new location in Sparks, Maryland. And Mr. Bradley spearheaded a effort to name a gallery after Coach Moran. And he was able to do that with contributions from lacrosse players and other people that Richie had coached over many, many years. It was done on September 11th, which was, interestingly enough, the 15th anniversary of 9/11. And one of Richie's best lacrosse players, Eamon McEnany, lost his life in 9/11. He was a floor manager for the company that he worked for in helping people during emergencies, and his company was on the 110th floor or 109th floor, and, you know, we all know how that ended. But at any rate, I thought it was especially appropriate that people worked very hard to get Coach Moran the recognition that he deserves. He was a great coach, a way better guy, and he was also, when I was on the city council, and it's not about me, he was a member of the Ithaca Planning Board, which I would go to the meetings just to hear him talk. He was not particularly sensitive to all planning issues, but he certainly took a position on everything, and it was pretty cool to listen to him. So I think as a member of, you know, I've been here since the early 70s. My kids played lacrosse with his children and one of his guys and his son, Kevin. It was a great honor for him and a great honor for the community.
Anna Kellis.
Thank you, Jim. I wanted to speak about an event that happened last night. There was a community read kickoff panel discussion for the new Jim Crow community book. Basically, it's a book group to review the book and discuss the book and learn from the book. And I was unable to go to that because I was in a liaison appointment for the legislature, but I did speak to some of the people who were there, and it was an amazing event. The first introduction and chapter review, if anybody still wants to get involved, is October 17th at 5:30 at GIAC, and it will continue from there. And I also would like to invite, I know for all of the legislators, we're all very busy doing all of the millions of things that we're doing, but I wanted to invite you, if any of you or the staff here for the county want to do our own book group, there has been an invitation for a facilitator to join us, and I have copies of the book for us, so whether or not we are able to form a group of our own, I do have copies of the book for people to read, and I think that it's very important because of what is going on in our country right now. There's a lot of violence happening, but there's a lot of voices being heard that have not been heard. So I also consider it an opportunity to address something that is needed to heal some deep wounds in our country. So I see it as a great opportunity, and the more educated we are, the better. So I have these if anybody wants copies. There's also a film series, and it starts November 17th with Slavery by Another Name, and that's at the Tompkins County Public Library. And I have a bookmark that has the further information, but that's the first one. So.
Thank you, Anna. Rich John?
Thank you, Mike. I wanted to give a shout-out to the Ithaca Journal. And I'm holding up, this is Monday's front page and then today's paper. And they did a very detailed, fact-heavy story about the pharmaceutical industry and their involvement with the opioid medications. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I'd really encourage you to go out and buy a copy of the Ithaca Journal to encourage them to continue to do this kind of journalism. It's really a great example of what journalists can do in bringing these stories to light. Unfortunately, it's a very depressing story. It does seem that this is a problem that was decades in the making, and it fundamentally involves what you might call corruption among the political players in state after state, where there's just been a failure to address the prescription issues that have arisen from opioids. And what's going on now with trying to do what are called new drugs that are more difficult to crush or to make into a liquid, but really are an extended patent device for the pharmaceutical industry, and they cost more. And what the pharmaceutical companies are now pushing through their lobbying groups are that only the new drugs should be available. At any rate, it's a good thing that this story came out. I think we have a lot to think about when you read it. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Will Burbank, and then we'll go to Dave McKenna.
Thank you, Mike. This Sunday was Porch Fest. I saw several of you there, and I always try to put it on my calendar because I think it's one of the most wonderful examples of the richness and diversity of our community. As people know, it's people lend their porches and musicians and come and perform an amazing variety of music, ranging from skilled amateur to absolute professional. And then people move around by foot and bicycle and whatever, and it is just the streets alive in the best kind of way. Free food, there's somebody grilling up hamburgers and hot dogs, just giving them away. Church makes their facilities available. They give away cookies and say, come use our bathrooms and everything. What I had not realized, however, is that Porch Fest started here in Ithaca in 2007, and it is now literally going around the country, and it's starting to go around the world. You can find Porch Fests west in Canada and Utah. So it's a wonderful, wonderful idea. And if you haven't had a chance to do it, I would encourage you to do it next year.
Thanks, Will. Dave?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank Glenn for his report on the trip last Friday. I was also on that trip. And special thanks to Debbie Teeter and the Farm Bureau for sponsoring and setting it all up. So thank you all very much, and all the farmers that participated and allowed us access to their property. Thank you.
All right. Carol.
Thanks to all of everybody who's spoken, from the various municipal officials to us. I mean, what a wealth of information and we all bring. So I want to thank those who went on the farm tour that I wasn't able to go on to give us information about it. And I want to thank Rich in particular for the, you know, trying to summarize the piece in the Ithaca Journal. But I want to speak for just a second about the in defense of government from that piece. And I don't have all the details because I have not made it through the entire both halves of the article. But what struck me was the attempt by these various state governments and federal government, I believe, but state governments to look at the issue and to act. And the systematic attempt, the millions, I mean, hundred and something million dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. Oh, wait a second. 880 million plus 4 million, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars put into the lobbying and the preparation of materials to get state government after government to weaken
the legislation that was being proposed so that something would come out that was stronger than what had been in there before, but that was seen as a compromise, but that still enabled Big Pharma to make a lot of money off of, you know, if you were able to put $880 million into lobbying, think how much you're actually making that you're willing to put that kind of money in. So I think that there was a lot of good intention. It's an interesting lesson in what can happen along the way. Thanks.
Leslie McBean Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Anna, for mentioning the Community Read kickoff event, and I hope that as a county we can participate in it. There are various sort of discussions that will be taking place at GIAC. Anna mentioned the first date, and I hope that folks will attend. But I also want to mention that tomorrow evening, the 21st of September at 7 p.m. at Cinemopolis, there is a viewing, a free viewing of the documentary Eyes on the Prize, and it's followed by a panel discussion that will be facilitated by Nicole Lefebvre and Jamila Walida Simon. It is sponsored by the Multicultural Resource Center, Black Lives Matter Ithaca, and the Kernel Public Service Center. So 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, September 21st at Cinemopolis, documentary viewing of the award-winning Eyes on the Prize.
Thank you. Anyone else? Very good. Let's move on. Tonight, we're very pleased to have a special presentation, and we invite Katie Borghella and Megan McDonald up from our planning department to talk to us about community government greenhouse gas emissions and energy use inventories. We're going to put the screens down, so we'll suspend long enough to do that. At the microphone, they've been joined by our director of planning, our planning commissioner, I should say, Ed Marks.
Thank you, Mike. Let me just introduce this presentation by Katie and Megan by saying this is probably one of the most complicated areas of government I've been involved in, and I've been involved in a lot of areas of the county government since I've been here. I don't think there's any issue that's got more complexities to it. And an amazing amount of effort has gone into getting the best grasp on this issue that we can on the local level. But it's an evolving area, and we're going to continue to learn more week by week, month by month going forward that will help clarify some of these issues. But this is really important that we take this comprehensive look from time to time and tell us where we are and give us some insight as to where we might be, should be going in the future. So with that, I'll turn it over to Katie.
Thank you very much. So you are probably aware that we have been doing this for a while, periodically. We began doing this in 1998, so we're pushing 20 years of looking at greenhouse gas emissions, both for the county and the community at large. In 2014, we tried to build on the work that we did with the Energy Roadmap. So for the first time, we're really looking at a detailed accounting of energy flows, not just the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the energy, but where's the energy coming from and how is it being used in the community, and really trying to track renewable energy resources because, again, it's such a big component of the Energy Roadmap. We're also looking at new climate science and what that means for decision-making into the future, which we'll go into a little bit more later in the presentation. And then for the government side of things, really, again, very detailed tracking of our facility energy use, fleet inventory, and renewable energy credits. So our progress has been excellent. You can see in the purple there, those are the goals adopted by the legislature on behalf of the community and for the county government. So we've got our target emissions in 2020 and 2050, and you can see on the left-hand side the 2008 numbers, which was our baseline year that we're comparing ourselves against moving forward, and 2014 numbers. So for county government, we're seeing a 53% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, which is really quite outstanding and speaks to the leadership of the legislature and our administration and staff. In the community, we've also seen a great reduction, 21% reduction in emissions. There are other considerations, which is the specifically how you account for this transition in using hydrofracked natural gas opposed to vertical well natural gas. And that will be covered later in the presentation. So the community. We saw a reduction in emissions in all sectors except for transportation. Transportation, we saw a 2% increase in emissions. In terms of energy use in the community, that also went down, except for transportation, which is relatively flat. But we saw a 6% decrease in overall energy use, and when you look at it per person, we saw a 9% decrease in energy use. So, again, this speaks to the amount of attention and energy and resources that have gone into this topic by Cooperative Extension and the Park Foundation and just many, many people and organizations, including the county, working on energy issues. Renewables really took off in this time period, 136% increase in renewables, primarily solar. The growth of solar was outstanding, and improvements at Cornell's hydro plant as well. Some of the reasons for the progress, what we just covered, there, less energy was used, which can result in great emissions reductions. Cornell, during this time period, converted from coal to natural gas. And if you use this general accounting for methane, that makes it so that it's a great reduction. If you look at it the other way, it's not so great. But, again, we'll cover that later. Growth of renewables was incredible. And then changes to the electric grid. And, again, this looks at this transition from coal to natural gas was pretty substantial in our grid as well as at Cornell. So with general accounting, it really helps us out. With this new climate science accounting, it hurts us. So it's a little complicated trying to tell these two stories at the same time in this document, but we felt it was important for everyone to know what the situation was so we can make good choices moving forward. I will turn it over to Megan, who's going to talk specifically about what happened on the county front.
Thank you. So in terms of the county government facilities and operations, I think this can also be framed as an example, when we look at the whole community, an example of what one organization can do. And it's been quite a bit. As you may recall, the county sustainability strategy talks a lot about leadership by example. And I think the reduction in emissions and energy use that we've seen in county government operations really speaks to the action that underpins those words. And so, as Katie mentioned, we've had a 53% decrease in emissions overall. Here you see it broken down both by buildings and facilities, as well as our vehicles and other off-road equipment. And I should say, in terms of buildings and facilities, we've seen a 16% decrease in energy use since 2008. And we've also seen a decrease in our vehicles and equipment as well. So this speaks to both. One thing I should mention is in the report you'll find that our emissions have been greatly affected by the purchase of renewable energy certificates, which are attached to renewably generated electricity. This is electricity generated by other parties. with renewable resources, but that the county purchases and is therefore able to claim credit for the environmental benefits of that electricity. But it's also important to note what our actual energy use is so that we can understand that we're making progress both in our energy consumption as well as in our emissions reductions. In terms of energy use, here you see in blue on the left the 2008 energy use by building or facility and then compared to 2014. So again, we've got a 16% decrease overall, which is remarkable. You can see, we can talk a bit coming soon, improvements to the airport terminal will be helpful there. And this is all information as well that can help guide future efforts as we look at particular buildings and facilities to see where additional progress can be made. I think it's also worth noting where policy can really make a difference. And if you look at the Biggs building over towards the left, and then you look over to the health department, you can see what a difference that new building has made, even with terrific facilities. In terms of our vehicle fleet, we've seen a 30% decrease in emissions. And again, you may recall that the county adopted the Green Fleet Policy, and that's guided a lot of changes that have helped us to decrease our emissions that I'll go into in further detail in just a moment. Also, as Katie mentioned, throughout the community, renewable energy has been growing, and it also has been taking off on county facilities. The county actually owns the solar panels on the Tompkins County Public Library, and so that solar energy, we claim the environmental benefits for. We retain those renewable energy certificates, those RECs. The other facilities to the right of the public library, these are leased solar panels, so we are generating renewable energy there, but we are not claiming the environmental benefits, and so that's not included in our emissions reduction since those are RECs that can be purchased by others. And additionally, in the report, you'll find an appendix that calculates our emissions without the RECs as well. So if you want to compare, you know, see what a difference the RECs made, you can look at it, the calculations both ways. So where did this progress come from? 53% is pretty astounding. And there are a number of things at play here through concerted effort. In terms of our buildings, again, those RECs have been critical in lowering our emissions from electricity consumption. Also, as Katie mentioned, the changing electric grid, that's energy that the county consumes for its facilities and operations. And so that conversion from coal towards more natural gas has reduced emissions under the conventional accounting practices. Also, we have the energy performance contract with Johnson Controls, so a number of our buildings have received improvements and are continuing to be tweaked in different systems and monitoring, and that has helped us reduce energy consumption as well. And then there's this kind of wild card factor, occupancy and behavior. It's harder to quantify, but I think it does have an impact, and it's an area that we talk about in the sustainability strategy, you know, going forward in terms of employee education and such, that you know, the number of bodies in a building affect the HVAC system, the amount of equipment, what that equipment is, how cognizant we are of how we use our equipment and turning off on and off lights, and all of those things work together to also impact our energy use. In terms of fleet, the switch of highway vehicles that began after 2008 towards using biodiesel has reduced our emissions. It's a cleaner burning fuel. And additionally, diesel engines have become somewhat cleaner, so as diesel equipment was replaced, those are more efficient vehicles reducing emissions. The Green Fleet Policy, we've seen a number of hybrid vehicles purchased since implementation of that policy. There's car sharing happening between departments. So departments and county employees are thinking proactively about how to improve the efficiency of our fleet, how we use it, what those vehicles are. CAFE standards, fuel economy standards, have been improving for vehicles. and the county tends to have a newer fleet than the average household might. And so we've replaced a number of vehicles between 2008 and 2014, and for the most part, those have become much more efficient vehicles. So even if they were driving the same mileage, they would be emitting fewer emissions, or less CO2. Also, changes in vehicle use. This is more anecdotal evidence, but I think a lot of us have been seeing changes in how meetings are held, how many times you may be driving to Albany or other cities, even driving between departments for in-person meetings. Technology is allowing us to have more conference calls, more webinars, and so anecdotally there have been some changes people feel from 2008 to 2014. How vehicles needed to be used. And additionally, there have been some program changes within departments that have changed vehicle use. And there's also an appendix in the document that provides a breakdown by facility and also the departments in those facilities that talks about their energy consumption as well as vehicle fleet use. And that provides additional details about specific things that improvements that may have happened to those buildings and also changes to the fleet that could affect emissions from those departments. So the evolving story, fracked gas, as Katie mentioned, this can really change the results. And we thought it was important to account both using conventional practices and the protocols available for local government and for the community, and to also look at what the impacts are with fracked gas and where the science is going. So most of our natural gas as of 2014 consumed is now coming from shale gas, from fracked gas, with the primary component being methane, and that's pretty important because of the global warming potential of that methane. In terms of the research, we now know that there's a great deal of leakage going on between extraction of the natural gas to its point of consumption. There are a variety of opinions right now about what that actual percentage leakage is, and we've looked at that using some of the ranges that experts have helped us to calculate. The mouse got ahead of me. So that's why you'll see this 5 to 19% leakage rate calculated. In terms of the global warming potential, conventional accounting practices look at the 100-year global warming potential, but methane is much more significant in the short term. It has about 100-fold more warming potential than CO2 in the short term, and so that's where we see there's a high probability that accounting practices will be starting to look at the shorter term because the shorter term, we know a lot is going to happen with our climate in that time period, and that this also points to where we need some really fast action because this is going to be critical in helping to steer our path for the future. So in terms of accounting for that fracked gas, both in the government inventory as well as in the community inventory, in red here you'll see the 2008 calculations with a bit additional worked in for the leakage that was present at that time in 2008. And I'll say that Dr. Bob Howarth and other experts have provided critical guidance in helping us determine the calculations and the methodology for calculating this. And then you'll see, stepping up to the right, 5%, the 12%, and the 19% leakage rates. So if we go kind of middle of the road there, you would see that from 2008 to 2014 at that 12% leakage rate, government emissions actually went up by 10% instead of down by 53%, and community by 67%. So this is part of that evolving story. The good news, and then unfortunately this is the bad news, but it also is very useful in helping to guide our next steps. So in terms of future actions, with this information, it really points to these three critical areas of focus. Natural gas, obviously this has a huge impact as we're starting to understand the evolving science and thinking about how this can be impacting what our true emissions are and what the effects will be. it speaks to the critical need to move away from natural gas obtained from hydrofracking. And as part of that, this growth in renewables will be important as we make that transition. Also, transportation continues to be a big emitter, both for community and government. We're stepping down, but there's a lot of progress to be made yet. And so where we can be reducing miles and also lowering our emissions per mile, that's going to be key in our continuing quest to meet our 2050 goals. So all of these documents and methodologies are and supporting information are available online, and I'd like to take a chance to answer any questions. And
okay, thank you for that interesting and clear presentation. Let's get questions from Carol, then Anna.
So I want to say a few things. First, maybe we can have more light while we ask the questions. First, I want to say this is an absolutely brilliant piece of work. It was a lot of work, and I think it's groundbreaking, and I'm really proud of us and you for having conducted this. And I think that we ought to find ways to make sure it gets out into the world as an example of the ways in which one can study these things. So I want to talk a little bit about the problem with it, as you pointed out, and then suggest a couple of solutions. So one, the problem that, as you point out, is that we now know a whole lot more than we did even when we started this analysis. And we're not, it's almost like this issue of the methane, and is that a problem for the atmosphere, is almost like ignoring it or even putting this out without a little more of a disclaimer is almost like turning to Mrs. Lincoln and saying, you know, apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? If you're Cornell University, we achieved a lot of what we did, partly, as you pointed out, partly because Cornell, you know, put in their whole new gas-burning plant to power the whole campus. If you're Cornell, you can now, 8 years later, turn around and to be talking about and looking into a whole new system that that alleviates that issue. Because now they're saying, well, methane is a problem, and so we're going to look into, you know, ground source heat use. And they can afford to spend a lot of money doing that. The rest of us, when we make those kinds of decisions, it's a 40- or 50-year decision. We spend that kind of money, you know, if I spend that kind of money on my house putting in a system, it's probably a 20-year decision. Or if you're a business, it's that long. So it's a big problem, and I think that we have to make sure that we as we put this out into the world, that we make sure the world knows not only in a disclaimer at the beginning and the end, but sort of along the way, that this is not inclusive of methane emissions. So the solution, I see a couple of things we could be doing. And this is not in any way to discredit the brilliance of this work, which is that since the charts of the progress we've made, which we're so proud of, includes this in there, to just put a note on the bottom of the relevant charts that say, you know, note, not inclusive of methane emissions, and people can then draw their own conclusions. And the other thing that I think we ought to do is put it out there not just for governments, but maybe somehow try to get it into the academic literature or to those who might be able to take what we've done and then come back to other governments who do this or for us the next time around and have worked out the template of how to build it in based on what came out of Paris and the IPCC and using, we shouldn't have to reinvent it again. So those were my thoughts.
Anna?
Thank you very much.
One One question that I can get out of the way rather quickly. I just wanted to know where the conversation about the RECs and NYSEG wanting to take those back, where does that stand? Do you guys have any idea where that confrontation stands?
We haven't heard anything recently about that.
So that's still potentially on the plate that we could lose those RECs?
One thing I should note, though, is the hydro remote net metering agreement, which will is yet to be seen in terms of the exact calculations. It may kind of cancel out the RECs in terms of increasing our efficiencies. That's going to provide around 63% of the county government operations electricity, and so that improvements in the near future to the airport terminal, some of these things may help to make those RECs less critical in terms of our overall emissions.
Right. And the Cornell issue with RECs was with respect to NYSERDA keeping RECs for things they had funded, since we aren't really claiming any RECs from NYSERDA-funded items, it would not affect the emission inventory you've heard tonight.
Awesome. So then my second question, when I was going through the reports, and you showed a chart of the reduction in emissions, but on the subsequent page in the report, there's the chart of the reduction in consumption, and there's a substantially less difference between 2008 and 2014 with respect to consumption rather than emissions, which to me implies that we're not necessarily getting that much better in using less, but that what we're using is more efficient with respect to conversion from consumption, and it's releasing less emissions. So my understanding is that's primarily due to the switch to natural gas, because our estimation from the old system is that it's has less emissions. So then in that context, it puts that chart into question that we're actually getting less emissions. And so I would love to see maybe a little bit of the story talk about our consumption, or maybe focused more on our consumption and reducing that and maybe emphasizing that in where to go next as a way of, regardless, how do we address that issue? Because either way, then, you know, it'll be a net gain. So the last thing that I wanted to mention was, I guess, just a big concern for me is that we know that there is some leakage, and we do know that the protocols are going to change relatively soon because we have all this new information. The story that we're putting forward that I think is really awesome is that we set a goal, and we as a county, and I really appreciate the staff and the whole initiative to do this, we set a goal and we took the action steps to do it. It's unfortunate we had faulty information from 2008, so the decisions we made led us down a road that now we know might not have been the best choice. And I think that, for me, that's a better story, that we have this incredible ability to follow through and make this initiative. So I think prefacing it for me with we have reduced our emissions is scary if people like listen for a couple minutes and walk away with that, because we may not have actually done that, but what we have done is tremendous, which is follow through with what we said we were going to do. I don't know if that distinction, I guess you can speak to that.
Well, I would say the county hasn't made a lot of decisions as county government that moved us to a greater reliance on natural gas. We've done some things to reduce our consumption. We haven't made major new investments in natural gas, substituting that for something else. So I think that's something we'll be looking at going forward, but I don't think we've made any really bad decisions.
I don't either.
In that regard. With regard to efficiency, you know, if you look at the roadmap, we in our other strategies, we always have said that we have to use energy more efficiently, and we have to get it from cleaner sources. And those are really that's really all we can do. So those are, you know, going to be continually focuses for our efforts, both in the community and in county government. But we do need energy, too, to do a lot of the things we do, and getting it from the best source possible is really important. So there's, you know, move to renewables, while you're using it as efficiently as you can is really critical. And, you know, if the state really can achieve what it wants to achieve in terms of moving the grid to renewables, truly moving it to renewables, we see how that really has a big impact. What happens in the grid has a huge impact on our emissions. So there's a lot of things going on that if they work out will help a lot, but we still have major initiatives we hope to be able to move forward at the local level.
I think just the last thing I would say to that is I totally agree. I'm just concerned about the messaging, and I'm feeling more cautious to say that, you know, we've done a great job in moving in a direction to say we've reduced our emissions, given that the calculations may be changing very soon. I might put us in, you know, as a county, that be our message.
And I think it's really hard to, I mean, also for a local government and a small department within a local government to, you know, go much further than we've gone. If you looked at the chart, by the experts, we were given a range of 5 to 19%. So even amongst the experts, you've got a range there that's huge with massive implications, depending on what end of that scale we might or may not be at. So this science is still not very firm or certain, and it's definitely evolving, and we need to put a lot more effort, not as a county, but as a nation internationally, on firming up the science so we really know what it is we should be measuring against.
Well, and I think that is the greatest thing that you can be congratulated for, and I was so profoundly proud of this report, and it's the last thing that I would say is the transparency. The acknowledgement of that is the greatest strength, because it said to me that you were much more interested in the truth and the science, and that you put that message out to me. I was profoundly grateful.
I had a question, and that is, for 50 years or so, natural gas was developed from the old-fashioned wells, straight down drilling all over the country, and it wasn't until the last, decade, 20 years, that they went to hydraulic fracturing. And you mentioned several places if we have reliance on fracked gas. Is there a difference between the old-fashioned gas as far as the leakage compared to what would be leaking with the new hydraulic fracking process?
Yes. I mean, that's what we're being told by the scientists, that the fracturing process by its nature emits a lot of gas in the process at the well.
Isn't a lot of leakage in the pipelines?
Well, if you looked at the comparison to recalculated 2008, we had 3-point-something% in there, which is basically that counting for that distribution leakage if the gas was coming from conventional wells. So the increases reflect the additional leakage associated with hydrofracking, which, again, the range is quite large and still needs to be made more certain, but there is clear evidence that there's a much higher leakage at the wellhead in fracking, and that's what's accounted for in there.
Thank you. Other questions? Jim Dennis.
That's an interesting point, Ed. Does the industry recognize this fact that they're causing this leakage, and do they actually operate on a day-to-day basis saying, well, we know we're doing this and we're not trying to do anything about it?
We've heard a lot of things from the industry. Some claim that the leakage isn't happening. For a long time, the only data came from the industry. There was no independent data collected. So that was kind of difficult to go based on. But there has been recently some, methods of detecting gas at the wellhead through various methods that have started to document this leakage. And so there is, evidence, clear evidence that this is occurring. The EPA is starting to pay attention and starting to talk about rules to limit that. But they aren't in effect at this point in time. So it could get better, but what we're told by some of the scientists is that by the very nature, it's going to be difficult to control it. A lot of that leakage from the fracking process itself.
It's NOAA, I think, is the one that documented it.
National OSHA, the atmospheric people.
Yeah, and other independent scientists have done work on this. But it is an area where there's been very little research done relative to the magnitude of the problem. And so that's a real concern. It really does need to be looked at. But recently, the International Panel on Climate Change scientific community has identified methane as a much greater concern. They're seeing worldwide emissions that trying to account for them based on other known sources is difficult. So there's definitely something going on with methane. At the same time, there's been a big move to fracking for gas. So there's both anecdotal and scientific direct observation evidence to suggest that this is the case. But we don't know all the answers by any
means. Let me just say that I applaud you on the report. It's very extensive, and I know that you've spent a huge amount of time getting it to this point. So thank you for that.
Thank you all. Thanks for coming tonight and sharing this with us, and I think we all join Jim's comments there.
Yes, thank you.
Let's suspend and put the screens up. Oh, she says we need them later, so we'll leave them down. For my report, I attended the Regional Economic Development Council meeting in Johnson City last week. I sent you all out an email and told you some results of the consolidated funding application process throughout the Southern Tier region, where locally in the Southern Tier, we can only score 20 out of 100 points for a project. There were over 140 projects that had applied. About 49 of them were considered potentially scorable in the with 15 or 20 points. And of those, there were 21 recommended. And they were scored by the economic development people on the executive council, not the political people. So that's how that works. The two projects in Tompkins County are the Cargill Salt Mine project to help fund the punching of a new shaft for that mine that will make it safer and will allow the mine to be ventilated if they move further north with the mining. And also the College Town Transit proposal, which I don't have all the details on, but I believe it's basically a revitalization for the College Town area. If we're not successful in getting the $25 million, we will still get $10 million, but the 20 projects will have to be pared back, either in which ones are funded or the amount of funding for them, or some combination of that. They will leverage $176 million, this $25 million in local business investment, private investment. It'll retain 980 jobs predicted, and it will create 462 new jobs. Yes, Carol.
Can I ask a question about that? I was curious about the choice of Cargill. Did we choose that, or was that submitted independently to the REDC?
When you say we,
Tompkins County, in any way, because I was interested.
No, these are submitted by the applicants
directly
through the process.
Okay. At some point, it would be interesting to have Jay tell us something about why Cargill only pays property tax on a fraction of their operations. It has to do with New York State and the definition of real property. Going back to the 1800s.
Might be something to be talked about in government operations. I think probably not tonight here.
Might be useful for all of us to know about this. Thanks,
Mike.
Yes, Julie.
Excuse me. Is the Cargill application that you all evaluated or looked at available for us to see?
I don't think so. I think these are proprietary, and they're held by the region. We all don't get to see them. They're only reviewed by the executive committee. We have two people from Tompkins County on the executive committee. One is Michael Stamm, and the other is Mary Opperman. Jim Dennis.
If you've all been listening, Cargill came to the IDA a week or so ago asking for a sales tax exemption on the drilling, on the new project that they're going to be doing at the site. And the explanation given to us was, I think, legitimate, and it essentially extends the life of the mine another 20, 25 years because they, you know, the business of salt is the business of salt. They need to get bigger, and if they're not able to get bigger, then, you know, at some point they have to say, we're going to shutter the place. And clearly, you know, that's not something Tompkins County can afford, and clearly the town of Lansing and the school district in Lansing cannot afford. So we have moved the application ahead, and there will be a public hearing on it soon.
A couple of other things I wanted to mention. There were a number of grants discussed from other things other than the CFA projects, and one of those was for water grants. And there were a number of municipalities in the southern tier that received grants for water projects totaling about $14 million, which is about 50% of the cost of those projects. And I specifically asked whether this will be continuing next year and was told yes. There will be more water grants next year. I know there, my village in Dryden has been looking for grant money. And we've been talking ever since the drought happened about the issue with Bolton Point and whether or not it would make sense for the three entities that potentially could receive water in a crisis situation from Bolton Point, two of them anyway, whether we should try to find the funding to increase the capacity of that filtration plant down there. So I just was pointing out that that might be an area that we can take a look at for funding. And the last thing I wanted to mention is I had a call today from Sandy Price over in Cortland County. They're looking to set up another of our what seem to be semi-annual lunches with the Cortland County legislators. It would be in Tompkins County this time. They were suggesting perhaps Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday of the week of the 19th. So if folks have any thoughts on that, just get to me about that, and we'll see what we can come up with. I have one appointment, and that is to the Tompkins County Workforce Development Board. Dr. Brian K. Dickens is the business representative. Let's go to other reports from our county administrator, Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Michael. I've just got three items tonight, and I'm going to yield a little bit of my time, if you're allowed to do such a thing, to Paula later on as a part of the GEO report. She'll be talking a bit about the Title VI program, so we'll do a PowerPoint for that. Just the three things that I have on my list, one's kind of an old item. The court study that was done some time ago and presented to TCOG at its last meeting, we've talked about bringing Ray Schlatter, who chaired that group, to this meeting to present findings to you. His court schedule has gotten in the way of some times. We're still looking at either your next meeting or the meeting after that for Ray to make a presentation. But if you're interested and you haven't seen the report, it is available online. If anybody else who's watching this is interested as well, it's available online on the county's webpage. It's in the popular links box. You'll see the Municipal Court Task Force, and there you can see the entire report, and it's a good read, and it's worth reading. Second item on my list, more fun. Jonathan and I took a field trip yesterday. I went to Leslin's meeting dressed in jeans and a T-shirt yesterday because of a field trip that we took.
Thanks for the explanation.
To visit, I didn't want you to think it was disrespectful, to visit the dam that's in Waterloo that's going to be supplying the lion's share of our electricity to us before the end of this year. Ed talked about all the good things that we've done on the energy front. This may be among the very best and certainly among the most unique things that we've done. And so we had a chance to visit that dam. it's really interesting. It opens your mind. I mean, when we think about ways to green up our energy supply and do things differently, we think of very high-tech stuff, space-age things. And when you look at this plant, it is vintage 1914, and the old stuff still works really well. So it was really an interesting experience. And again, it will be well over half of our electricity that we will receive from that facility quite soon. We'd like to do something to get the legislature there and do something kind of formal to kick this off on site. So we will be reaching out to you to look for dates and times. It may work for you to get in a car or bus or something and head to Waterloo to be able to tour this facility, but also commemorate the fact that this is a really important development and celebrate the fact that we will soon be getting so much of our power from the hydro plant. Last thing on the list is the jail study. So we've been working very hard on developing an RFP for the first part of that process, which is the criminal justice and population projection study. We drafted an RFP quite early. We ran it through the jail study committee, Rich's committee, a week or so ago, got a lot of good input from that group, incorporated that into a revised document, cleaned it up, made it look better. I've circulated it to the committee, and I'm hoping that tomorrow we can get that RFP on the street. It's really important that we move with speed because I think we'd like to have the consultants retained by December 1st. We'll be visiting with the Commission of Correction just about then. And I think it's really important that we have someone in place by December 1st. This will allow us to, if we hurry, meet that deadline and still give us time to make a thoughtful decision about the consultant that we want to select to do that work. So that's my report.
I would just add that should we need a special meeting of this group in order to make sure we hit that deadline, I would call it. So hopefully we won't, or if we do, we'll call it ahead of another meeting like we did that one a couple weeks ago. Leslie.
Mr. Chair, since you said that, I would please request that if special meetings are called, that we try to look at the 5:30 time as opposed to earlier.
I think that makes sense.
Thank you.
Any more questions for Joe? Let's go to Jonathan Wood, our county attorney.
I have no report.
Questions? Rick Snyder, our director of finance.
I just have a quick item tonight. If you turn in your folders, we have the sales tax distribution summary. One more month is in for the month of August. I'm joyous to announce that this month was up, our second month in a row. The county's portion of the sales tax distributions for August was up 0.33% compared to last year. That's just looking at 1 month, that column there that shows August compared to August of last year. There are some winners and losers. Martha, who's not here tonight, usually drills down and looks a little bit closer. Who is getting the benefit of the sales tax increase? As you can see, in the month of August, the county did have a pretty good increase of a third of a percent, but right below there you see the city of Ithaca at 5.33% increase. That's a wild card for them. And who's paying the price at this point in time in August? The towns and villages were down 4%. So we see this unequal distribution between the county, the city of Ithaca, and the towns and villages. If you move over to the year-to-date columns on the right-hand side of the spreadsheet, you see that year-to-date distributions for the county's portion totaled $21,070,378 compared to $21,159,886 in 2015. And this represents a decrease year over year of $89,508, which means we're down 0.42%. If you remember in looking at July's, we were down about 0.5%, and then 1 or 2 months before that, we were down about 0.7%. I think when we started putting the budget together, we were down 1.5%. So over the last 4 months or so, We have been closing the gap. I say we haven't done anything. Our reports are showing that sales tax receipts is improving ever so slightly over the last few months. I did a real quick and dirty little analysis just looking at how the months panned out from January through August, and we've actually had 4 months where we've had decreases in sales tax, and now with August we've had 4 months with increases in sales tax compared just 1 month at a time. So our condition is improving ever so slightly. Don't know if that's enough to make up for the difference in which Joe's shown in his budget that we're looking at to adopt in the next month or two. But I just wanted to let you know that it is improving, but at a very slow rate. And that's all I have for tonight, Mike.
Questions for Rick? Thank you, Rick. We always like to see it improving. Are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pull Resolution D, establishing policy regarding payment of re-levy taxes to towns and villages.
Leslie?
Mr. Chair, in consent agenda, Resolution C is being pulled.
Okay. Anything else? Those two are withdrawn. All right, then let's go to the consent agenda. We have one advisory board appointment out of the Public Safety Committee to the Stop DWI Advisory Board, Andrew Bonavia, District Attorney Representative. I'll read the resolutions on consent, left on consent, and if anyone wants them off the consent agenda, please say so. Resolution A, out of Health and Human Services Committee. Budget adjustments and transfer within the 2016 budget. Office for the Aging, ID 6574. Resolution B, budget transfer for the 2016 Tompkins County Office for the Aging Weatherization Referral and Packaging Program. Out of Government Operations, we go to Resolution E, authorizing a public hearing on proposed local law D.
Off.
That's off?
Yes.
Out of Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee, we have Resolution F, authorization to increase the use of program income funds to continue the home ownership program.
I have to pull that off.
That's off?
Well, because I can't vote for it.
Okay.
Unless
so,
I can
well, that's all right. All you have to say is off. So just the ones that are left on, I think, are A and B. Someone want to move those? Glenn, seconded by Anna. All in favor of the consent agenda, please raise your hand. Those opposed, that's unanimous. Now we'll go to our standing and special committees. We'll start with the old library committee, and I have no report because we haven't met. Public Safety Committee, Peter Stein, chair.
Public Safety Committee met an hour ago and passed two resolutions and sent them on to you. So I'd like to move those two resolutions. Resolution G. Number 6537. I'd like to move it. If there's
appropriation for contingent fund replacement pay sheriff's office.
Yep.
Is there a second? Seconded by Anna. Discussion? Those in favor, please raise your hand. I'm sorry, it's a short form roll call. We have several of those tonight, I'm told. Go ahead.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Does anyone want to be recorded as no on that? That's unanimous.
Okay, and now Resolution H, budget adjustment and appropriation of unspent funds from 2015 and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to the Public Safety Committee, ID number 6521. I'd like to move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Glenn. That's a discussion on that one. Short form roll call.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Does anyone wish to be recorded as a no? That's unanimous.
Okay, thank you. We have not met since the Public Safety Committee has not met since the last meeting, except for just before the beginning of this meeting to pass these resolutions. So I have nothing else to report.
Any questions for Peter? Thank you, Peter.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Dan.
Wonder if we can move resolutions E and K up. We have staff waiting for those.
Resolutions E and K.
They're both out of government operations.
Pulled off the consent agenda. I don't know why we can't, at your request. Go ahead and move resolution E out of your committee, please.
Thank you. I'd like to move resolution E, authorizing a public hearing on proposed local law number D of 2016, a local law enacting the late application procedure for the low-income senior citizen real property exemption.
Is there a second? Seconded by Carol. Discussion. Dooley?
I have a substitute or revised version of this resolution. I was concerned about making the grounds for appeal transparent to the public. And in that connection, I spoke with our county assessor, and he helped me revise this resolution accordingly. So I'd like to move to amend or substitute.
Let me just ask Dan, were you moving the substitute or are you moving the original?
He has to move.
I moved the original because it came out of committee, but I'm happy to, I consider that friendly to substitute.
Friendly? Is it friendly to the seconder?
Yes.
All right. Then it seems to be those are friendly amendments. So the one we'll be voting on is the one that's in your red folder tonight, showing the proposed changes.
Wait, can I ask the department whether that's okay? It's friendly to you, too? Okay. Yes, then it's friendly to me.
Yeah, I think that's what
he helped write
said. All right. Any further discussion on this? Ready to vote. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Are there any opposed? That's unanimous. You want to go to K?
Yes,
out of
please.
Your committee as well, Dan.
Thank you. I'd like to move Resolution K, approving amendments to Policy 11-39, commitment to serving the public without discrimination, and updating the Tompkins County Government Administrative Policy Manual.
Is there a second? Seconded by Leslin. Discussion. You see our deputy county administrator and friends. Do we want to hear from them?
Yes, please.
Paul Younger.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to present for your approval and adoption this evening Policy 1139. Which has been revised to meet regulatory obligations under Title VI, and thereby strengthening our commitment to serving the public without discrimination. As you may recall, plans have been underway since late last year to establish a formal countywide Title VI program. In fact, this was an item that the Compliance Committee adopted as a part of its work plan for 2016. You might recall that last summer the state invited us, I'll underscore that word, invite, to participate by way of being a grantee in a Title VI civil rights compliance survey. And the survey was designed to assess the degree to which the grantee satisfactorily demonstrated compliance under Title VI. And although we were able to respond well in a good majority of the survey areas, it was very clear that there were still some areas under Title VI that required some significant work. Specifically, we needed to improve how we demonstrate equal access, opportunity, and treatment to those that are entitled to take benefit of our programs and services. For clarification, this policy, 1139, which addresses our commitment to serving the public without discrimination, is not new. The policy was established in 1993. Regulatory requirements have changed since then, as well as directives on how we demonstrate Title VI compliance specifically. So the policy has been updated to meet these requirements.
The content of the policy and the complementary program document have been well researched. They meet best practice in terms of Title VI implementation, and they model recommendations set forth by regulatory authorities, most specifically the Department of Justice and its Division of Civil Rights. I want to walk you through the content of the policy briefly, just so you're very clear on what it is I'm asking you to approve tonight. And as I present the information, there is a document that I put at your place settings earlier tonight before the meeting started. It is a PowerPoint handout. Now, I'm not going to walk you through the PowerPoint on screen. We're going to show you something else relative to this. But I think this is going to be helpful sort of note-taking opportunity for you, and so I'll be using this document as I explain further. I want to also take this opportunity to acknowledge the Cornell Law School, the Law Clinic specifically, the ILR School, and the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs for their generous assistance in helping to prepare the policy and the complementary program document. Now, as I mentioned tonight, you will be asked to approve the policy only, and from that we can begin implementation. Title VI, as most of you might know, is a federal statute established in 1964, i.e. the Civil Rights Act, and it provides that no person shall be denied benefits or shall be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal dollars. And because the county is a recipient of federal fundings, the long and short of it is we get federal money, even if it's through, let's say, you know, a state pass-through grant program. If it's federal dollars, then we are obligated to follow through with Title VI requirements. Also, our contractors and subcontractors, although they are not required to have a Title VI program, they must comply with our program, so we also have an obligation to monitor their activities in that regard. What does Title VI mean for our county? Well, in essence, all county departments are responsible for identifying and eliminating discriminatory practices that prevent equal access. Some examples of what that might mean, I can't possibly cover all of them, but program participation, for one example, treatment, when we provide various treatment services and other related services, the way that we prioritize projects, or for that matter, the way that we allocate funding to particular projects. Public participation is a very significant area in Title VI. You actually model that when you allow for privilege of the floor for the public in your various meetings. We are also obligated to ensure that contractor and vendor opportunities are extended to minority businesses and minority-owned businesses. And then, of course, the way that we proactively follow through on Title VI complaints. I want to speak a little bit about how the program will be structured. So when you pass this policy, there are a number of components to our program. The Title VI program will be a part of our overarching county compliance program. And just as we have a program document for compliance, there will also be a program document specific to Title VI requirements. Included in that will be our limited English proficiency plan, which, congratulations, we already have that in place, and that's been in place for a couple of years, maybe going on 3 years now. We will also have an ADA program plan, that's Americans with Disabilities Act, and provide guidelines there. We will also provide guidelines for public participation. And then there is also a proposal for an inclusive business initiative which addresses minority and women-owned business requirements. Then how will we be implementing the program? Some of the things that regulatory officials look for is simply a public notice, of which we have one now, and we'll be able to publish it as such when this policy is approved. We will also have an approved complaint process, which will be accessed online, and I'll show you that in just a moment. We will expand the compliance training that we now give to staff to include Title VI. We're also in the process of developing various types of job aids, tools, and so forth, like fact sheets, FAQs, self-assessment tools. All of those things are in the plans to be developed. We also were successful, and thank you very much for approving, bringing on board a new compliance program coordinator. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce the young woman sitting to my right is Sarah Cantatori. And you'll see in just a few minutes how Sarah has been spending her time since she joined us on August 15th. In addition to having the program coordinator assist with Title VI as well as other compliance matters, we also are establishing a network of department-based Title VI coordinators. So we've asked every department to identify a member of their staff. We will have an orientation for these folks, but in essence, whenever we get a request from regulatory authorities or things that they might experience from their corresponding state agency or funders that have certain Title VI requirements, that they can also sort of share that information upward so that we create sort of what I've been calling like a learning community on Title VI so that we can share that information across the organization. What I would like to do now is to just draw your attention to the screen. And what you see is what we will be able to launch once this revised policy is in effect. Sarah has been working very hard to put together all of the information that I've gone over very quickly with you tonight to make that accessible via our county website. As you know, we already have a county compliance webpage set up. And if you look to the left of the screen, and you'll see a menu area, and right there at the bottom, it says Title VI program. And so when somebody clicks on that, what they're going to see is this page that's in front of you right now. It includes sort of the basic components that regulatory authorities are looking for, like our public notice, an explanation of what Title VI is. That has a lovely pictorial that you also had on your PowerPoint handout that actually offers all of the components of our Title VI program. And as each one of these components are completed, one can just simply click on the icon, for example, and see our LEP plan. Moving further down the screen, if a person has a Title VI complaint, and this is where we would direct all complaints. So if a person were to come into one of our departments, we would ask departments to direct them to our website. When you click on the link there, it actually explains what our complaint process is, you know, X number of days to actually respond and to investigate and so forth. And then the actual complaint form is accessible online. This is in a PDF, so it's downloadable. What we're also working on with the wonders of Laserfiche is that we will make this a totally electronic form so that it will allow us to track all of our follow-up and our investigations so that that will also satisfy record retention requirements. So just to sum up, after your approval this evening, we'll be able to move forward with all of the information that I've shared with you this evening. We'll be able to make what you're seeing now is a non-published draft web page. We'll be able to make that live and accessible. And that's the end of my introductory comments about what's before you. And if there are any questions, I can take them now.
Mike Sigler.
Just wondering. This kind of concerns me, this each department to designate a Title IX department coordinator. Title VI, sorry. So we're going to have more than 20 coordinators out there? I mean, and some departments are so much bigger than other departments. I guess that leaves me a little confused as to how many people are going to be doing this.
Well, yeah, we have 27 departments. In some cases, there are some that are organized by division. The only reason why we're asking this is so that when we need to give them updates with regard to Title VI, that somebody's readily accessible within the department, that they have a context for why it is we're contacting them and the information that they're giving us. It's just an easier way for information flow and, like I said, for learning both ways. Because Every department is different, different discipline, so the way that they're going to implement Title VI is going to be slightly different. You know, the way the highway department might do that is going to be different from how our mental health department does that, for example. So if there is learning to be shared with everyone, that will also make it easier to do that when we have coordinators that are sort of operating within that same Title VI context.
Will that interfere? I mean, that's an extra duty we're asking people to do. Is that going to interfere with our contracts and things like that?
I don't think so. I mean, when you consider that this statute's been around since 1964, this is really an obligation that we've had on the books for as long as we've been around, or as long as, you know, the Act has been around. We're trying to make it as easy as possible on departments. That's the reason why we're taking this comprehensive approach to Title VI. So they don't have to worry, for example, about having a public notice because it's already been prepared for them. One of the other things that we're doing is looking at, translating the notice into Chinese and Spanish, for example, so that departments don't have to worry about doing that. They really, if they are audited in any way and there's a question around Title VI obligations, here it is. It's right here. So we've already done, you know, the program plan, the website, all of those things. This is really for information sharing, and in the event that there's a particular audit that requires us to collect data on race, color, national origin, that we would have a go-to person at that department to help us do that. Because if we're audited, we're going to have to do that anyway. That's not, that's not something extra that somebody's going to do. It's what the auditor would be required of us, would be asking of us to do.
Paula, what provisions would we make for folks who wanted to file a complaint that were not computer active? I'm thinking of the elderly, for example.
Yeah. Well, of course, all of these things are downloadable, but they can certainly call our office, and we can put something in the mail to them. To some degree, we can simply take a complaint over the phone. If people need to come in to my office to see me about it, I'm accessible. So we're flexible that way.
Well, you said you're going to really be directing them to the website. Will the website say that? Oh, like if they weren't computer active, they wouldn't see the website, would they?
Right. Yeah. I think it's just more of if they happen to call in, that's the directive they'll be given. We can certainly mail them a form or whatever.
Leslie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You asked one of my questions. I don't remember seeing a phone number, just specifically in this. Oh, there it is. And then I had two things. Probably this one is for Marcia, but the other one is for you all. PDF downloadable, can it also be made as a fillable form, the complaint form? Could we work with IT to make that happen?
Right. When we actually convert to LaserFiche, or I should say add LaserFiche so they can have both options, that will be a fillable online form.
And then my other thing is there are programs that would allow for translation. And I'm wondering if that's something we can look into, just into different languages, as opposed to us just having only two languages, because we have so many languages in this community and beyond, to add whatever that program is, software, I don't know what it is, that would allow for being able to click on Mandarin or, Hindi or whatever it is to translate. That would be extremely helpful, and it would also sort of fulfill what we're saying that we're doing there. So that was for you, Marcia. Other than that, thank you also very much for the work on this.
I think I saw some other hands. Jim, then Carol.
It's not a question to you, Paula, but I have not met Sarah. And do you want to just say a few words about your new job and what you're doing here and all that? I would love to hear from you.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. So, like Paula said, my name is Sarah Cantatori. I am the Compliance Program Coordinator. So I will be working very closely with Paula on researching, planning, and implementing the county's compliance program. since I've started, I've been working almost entirely on Title VI, on getting this information on the website, getting the names of the Title VI coordinators from each department, working on putting together an orientation for those Title VI coordinators, where we'll be giving them an overview of what their responsibilities will be, but also inviting them to discuss what it is that they're already doing, what would be the best way to support them, and hopefully to have departments talk to each other about what they find works best. I'm also working on putting an ADA program plan and any other compliance issues as they come up.
Thank you.
And she's also a SEPA graduate.
Yeah.
We welcome you. Carol?
Yeah, welcome. Thanks for coming out here and for working on this. The question that Mike asked about, that's in the implementation phase. Is that written in the policy that each department will have its own separate person, or is that a detail that's of implementation in terms of how our staffing might work now and most immediately and in the future?
The policy simply states what departments must do, but the way that gets translated via the implementation plan is the designation of a Title VI coordinator. But that person is helping us carry out those items that are listed in the policy.
Is the fact that each department will have a person in the policy that we're passing tonight?
The language is simply that this is what each department must do.
Right.
What we're suggesting in terms of implementation to actually make those must-dos easier on departments is that by establishing a Title VI coordinator, that aids in making the transfer of information and updates and coordinating training and things like that much, much easier.
Okay. Thank you.
Leslie, did you have your hand again?
I did, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, the legislative policy statement and the old document, the 1993 document, had some other categories listed of individuals that we say we will not discriminate against. And I wonder if why those didn't come over. Is it just because Title VI has very specific categories listed, so ex-offender status was not in Title VI, but we are revising this policy, which I'm assuming this Title VI policy, well, commitment to serving public without discrimination, is going to replace what was there, the 1993 policy?
Yes, we upgraded this policy to reflect those obligations under Title VI, but what we also did was maintain the legislature's overarching view in terms of non-discrimination under your legislative policy statement. Now, it probably doesn't go in and cover every single possible non-discrimination experience, but it is stated there under your legislative statement.
I'm just thinking that given our most recent work on Ban the Box, that ex-offender status seemed very appropriate to have in there as well. That I'm just noticing that. I didn't, you know, see before when this previously came out. And so I'm just asking the question, can we only put the things that are listed on the Title VI, or can it be what the legislature has passed all the policies around that we can include?
Title VI only includes race, color, national origin, and with some extensions as a result of Title II and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, it also includes persons with disabilities.
Right. I got that. But there are other things that are listed here that are not on the Title VI as a legislative policy statement. So I'm asking, can ex-offender be up there as well?
In the legislative policy statement area?
Yes.
And where would you want to put ex-offender?
Wherever, all just, those, that just laundry list of...
Within the serial commas?
Yes.
Section?
I was just asking if it can be there. That's all, given what we just did.
We can add that to the legislative policy statement section. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Carol.
Well, wait. So does this policy replace the policy of 1993 that says that it commits ourselves to serving all persons without regard to race, color, sex, religion, age, marital status, national origin, disability, ex-offender status, Vietnam-era veteran status, or sexual orientation?
Yes.
It replaces it.
It replaces it in order to meet the obligations under Title VI. What I was hoping to do was not to suggest that the county never had a non-discrimination policy. So I was taking advantage of the non-discrimination policy that we had on the books and revising it to bring it up to standards to meet Title VI requirements, and trying to at least preserve some of your original intentions of that 1996 policy, of which nobody was around to really explain the background of that. I tried to preserve that in your legislative policy statement, that general statement about how you feel about non-discrimination.
Okay, so are there
as the legislative body.
Are there any other groupings of people that we protected in 1993 who are not covered? I'm trying to compare these two pages now. Like Vietnam-era veteran status.
That's military status.
But keep in mind, there are a variety of state and federal regulations of which you naturally abide by anyway. And you even have your own local human rights law. It's just that regulatory authorities now want to see a Title VI policy on the books, the same way that they want to see a whistleblower policy on the books. The same way that they like to see exclusion screening policy on the books. But there are a variety of state and federal statutes out there that say that you can't discriminate in a variety of categories, and those laws still stand. We're just trying to meet a compliance obligation by ensuring that we have a policy on Title VI.
So I certainly want to make sure that we're following Title VI and the sections of Title II that you had in your handout, but I also just want to make sure that there weren't groupings of people that we protected in 1993 that we are somehow letting fall through the cracks now. So that's what I'm asking. Does anybody see anything in that 1993 document that we're going to lose by not just referring to it here?
Okay, let's move on to Peter Stein.
Yeah, I want to continue this conversation. I don't really see any disadvantage to putting the largest list in there that you possibly can of things that we do ensure that kind of discrimination mm-hmm. is not allowed. Mm-hmm. So I agree. I don't see any reason for doing it because you say it's there someplace else, but one would not want people to think that the lack of the thing means that it's not a violation of this policy.
We'll be all right.
Okay, let's resume. Again, my apologies to Paula and Sarah. We were asking questions. Peter has had to leave, but I think hopefully he had his question answered. Who's next? Wants to ask a question? Dooley?
Go ahead. Leslin, thank you for bringing up what you did bring up, and Carol. As Paula knows, I have long felt that taking the title of our 1991 resolution and just adding Title VI to the end of it is fine as long as you don't lose sight of the original resolution. And at a minimum, I have tried to get Local Law 6 of 1991 added to the list of references in the list of references in the draft policy, and that has not been found to be friendly. I'm going to try that again now. I would like to see that added. And I have a separate question having to do with the human rights, our human rights department, our Office of Human Rights, I mean, because people who feel discriminated against are likely to turn their attention to that place for redress as they are to turn to this policy. And I don't know how to guide people to the correct one. So I'm not sure if there's a way to mention that alternative in this policy and make it clear when you use this one and when you go to our human rights office. I also, as will come as no surprise to any of you, care about words, and to me the distinction between policy and procedure is absolutely confounded in this particular policy for reasons that Paula made very clear, and I understand them, that Title VI people who are checking on us want to see if we actually enumerate the things that they're going to be looking for. And so those things which usually would be procedures are now called policies in this policy. And I understand that. My way of solving that dilemma would be to call the list of steps policy and procedure, covering both Title VI requirements and the English language requirements, in my view. So those are the changes I would like to see made in this.
Okay, we're still taking questions from the presentation.
So I am asking whether, based on other people's interest in our earlier law, it would be acceptable now to add a reference to that Local Law 6 of 1991 in the reference section up on the top.
Who are you addressing that to?
Paula or Paula, I guess.
Well, we had a similar discussion in the GO committee as well as an offline discussion with Legislator Kiefer about that item. We are trying to stay true to the requirements of Title VI. She's referencing a local law that is your human rights law, which actually includes a number of other provisions like housing and other things that are not relevant here to Title VI. And so that's the reason why that particular reference is not included in the reference section of the policy. It doesn't impact your local law at all. It just keeps Title VI in alignment with what federal authorities are asking for.
Dan, was that the discussion in your committee?
It was, yes.
Okay, let's get some other comments here. Carol is next.
Yeah, so I asked the question after, I remember having this discussion in committee, and when Leslin pointed out the ex-offender status, I panicked a little bit that there might be other things in here that were in the old policy that might not be in the new policy.
Now,
I took time during the break to look over it, word by word and line by line, and I've only found two possible things, and one of them is that, and the other one is Vietnam-era veteran status. Which
is covered under military status.
Well, military, but I might want to say current or prior military status. Because you might not have a current military status. But other than that, I went through, and Julie, I was concerned about whether we were doing the posting we did in the old policy, whether the confidentiality, the grievance procedures, and they really, I can't find any other than those two items that I don't see in the new policy. So if there's a way to address the one Leslin raised, ex-offender, and maybe something allusion to prior military status, you know, or further explanation about why we don't have to have the word prior in there. Other than that, I think we've covered it.
Well, military status is all encompassing.
Yes, I was just about to answer that.
Go ahead, Leslin.
In the law, it's all encompassing military status. So that is that one is clear
okay.
in the law.
And so what was the answer on the ex-offender?
And the only thing I'm asking to include is ex-offender status. Now, we don't want to muckety-muck up Title VI. You know, it's very straightforward and distinct. And because we're sort of replacing our old policy with this, because it's a regulatory requirement, you know, I think what's here is fine. I've read this, like many of you, several times over to make sure that we were covering everything and not going overboard with it, so that federal state folks can look at and can look at us and say, "What on earth is that?" So we want to make it the way it should be. But the legislative policy statement, that's our stuff. And that's why I was asking, and I think Paula answered that that would be okay. And if it's okay with this body, that we include ex-offender status because of resolution policy we just passed relative to ban the box, et cetera. So that's all I was asking, to have that included in our legislative policy statement part of it.
Moving.
So I can move that. I will move that.
Let me just finish the questions of our speakers, and then we'll come for amendments. I'll come back to you, Leslie.
Thank you, sir.
I had actually, looking at my list before we had to break, I had Jim and Mike. Did you still have comments?
I'm passing.
Mike, did you have another comment?
There was something listed up there about, it wasn't in the first paragraph, it's just stuff we have to look out for, but it was like aliens or something.
Alienage.
Yeah, and I don't know what that means. So.
That's primarily a legal term, and it speaks to non-citizens, of which there are several categories, and so the term alienage is just used to represent all of those categories. It's legal speak, and we just make sure that we put in what authorities ask us to.
Yeah, it used to be alien status until a bunch of us who were non-citizens got compliment, like, we didn't come from Mars. So it's now alienage, baby.
All right, Dan?
Yeah, you know, Paula has for a long time been tackling this difficult area of compliance, and as far as I can tell, she has never steered us wrong. I am interested in passing something that Paula is 100% on board with. If that requires that later on we pass a separate policy that says we also believe in the rights of whatever list we want to generate, that's fine. I'm really concerned about getting Title VI exactly right, so that when we get audited, there are no questions, there are no explanations, there's no penalties, there's no nothing. So I just wanted to say that. I am interested in Paula being 100% comfortable with whatever we say, whatever we pass tonight, and not trying to insert our own ideas into something that we know less about than Paula does.
Okay, I'll come back to you, Leslie.
Okay.
No,
oh, you're back to me now?
I'm back to you now.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to move one small amendment or legislative policy statement on this document to include in the list of classifications ex-offender status.
And I'll second it.
And moved and seconded. Discussion on the amendment. Go ahead, Leslie.
And may I just say thank you, Dan, for that, because I'm right where you are, that I do not believe that including that is going to make us not be in compliance with Title VI, because most of what's here covers that. And if Paula says, no, don't put that in, her and I will be rolling at the back of the room. Go ahead, girl. Say no.
No pressure, Paula.
Right. No pressure.
We had this as conversation.
I think that adding that is friendly. I also would just point out that, you know, the closing statement of that paragraph there, which is sort of all-encompassing for, I hope, that would address other concerns, and that is any other status or category protected by law, be it federal, state, or Tompkins County local law. So, I think a lot of the concerns that might have been expressed here in terms of making sure that all the protected classes are covered, that's part of the reason why that statement there ends with that phrase. But certainly we can add ex-offender to that list.
Dan, would that be friendly to you to add that or not?
Yes.
OK. Carol, you were the seconder?
Then yes, as long as it's friendly to the department. Yes.
All right.
Mike, none of them want to roll with me.
Yeah.
They're friendly.
You want to use my office? All right. Anything else on this? Can we adopt, vote on this resolution with that one change?
Yes, sir.
Dooley, is there anything you want to say further?
Sure. I would move to amend inclusion of our old-time non-discrimination local law as a reference, which does not take away from Title VI, but it has our history in it.
Would that be friendly?
I'm not sure I understand the request.
Could you say where you want to add it, please, Dooley?
In the reference list up near the top.
What packet page do you want?
52.
And you're just talking about the number of the law.
I'm talking about adding our local law 6 of 1991. Yeah.
As a reference.
Still not clear.
Point of information?
Under the reference list.
All right. Take your point of information, Rich. What's your point?
Aren't we doing that we're replacing the old local law?
Yes.
So we wouldn't reference the old local law because it's really just amending what we already had, so it's the same law.
The old law was not a Title VI law. Anyway, I think it needs to be referenced, and that's just me, and if nobody seconds it, it's not going to happen, and I can vote against this, and I'm perfectly willing to do that.
All right, so Dooley's been moving that as an amendment. Is there a second? Not seeing a second. I think it fails for lack of a second. So we're back to the main motion. Ready to vote? Dooley?
I will move the change, which has nothing whatsoever to do with Title VI per se. It has to do with our policy format on packet page 53. I will move to have letter B on that page entitled Policy and Procedure.
Letter B.
Each county department must.
You want to change from what to what, please, Dooley?
In the left-hand margin of this format, some things are called policy, some things are called procedure.
Mm-hmm.
It is my opinion that everything in letter B is really a procedure, but because of Title VI requirements, Paula feels strongly that they need to be identified as policy. So calling them both policy and procedure, to me, seems like the correct thing to do.
That's both Roman numeral 2 and Roman numeral 3 are you talking about?
I'm talking about letter B under Roman numeral 2.
The one that says each county department must. You're asking for B to be titled policy and procedure?
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
Under policy.
And number 3 remains, Roman numeral 3 remains as procedure? I'm confused, Betty.
Well, I feel less strongly about that. The first sentence is policy, the second sentence is procedure. I feel less strongly about that.
It's right. Is there a second for Dooley's amendment? Not seeing a second. Shall we proceed to vote on the resolution? Carol?
So, just Dooley, I took your suggestion about this really seriously, and I looked at it. And on this one, I feel, as Dan does, that it's, you know, technically, if I were writing this, I'd make the headers a little different. But if Paula feels like this is going to satisfy Title VI better, it's just not worth voting against something that is commitment to serving the public without discrimination. And on your point about replacing the 1993 law, I mean, I literally took advantage of the opportunity in the break to go through sentence by sentence, and there's nothing in the old one that isn't in the new one. So I would really would urge you to reconsider. I understand you like to stand on principle, but I – that these points seem to me to be less important than less substantive than us all standing together for the commitment to serve in the public.
I'm Jim and then Anna.
I'm going to call the question.
The question has been called. It's seconded by Mike Sigler. We'll proceed to a vote on calling the question. All those in favor of calling the question, this is on the full resolution with the one amendment. Those in favor of calling the question, please raise your hand. Those opposed? 1, 2, 3 opposed. We're calling the question. All right, we'll move to a vote on the adoption of the resolution for the policy. All those in favor, please raise
your hand. I would like a roll call vote.
All right, we'll have a roll call.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
No.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Oh, yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Morey?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Mr. Stein? Excuse. Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk? Mr. Lane?
Yes. Does anyone want to change his or her vote? Please announce the vote.
11 ayes, 1 no.
That's agreed to.
Thank you all. Thank you very much. I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
Paula. Thank you, ladies.
Okay.
Nice work, Dan.
Anything... No, we got to go back to the Health and Human Services Committee at this point.
Oh, we do.
Leslie McBean-Claiborne is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Health and Human Services met yesterday, Monday, September 19th. We had a few things on our agenda. I'll give you the highlights. We had a report and discussion about the health insurance marketplace by Beverly Chin with the Human Services Coalition. Just letting us know, open enrollment is November 1st through January 21st of 2017. And then there are a bunch of other things in between there about all the dates, depending on what plan one was trying to get in on. We have been trying over the last few months, not over the last few months, since we started HHS earlier this year, to review our departments and what's going on and get to know what is happening within our departments. Some departments are just too big to do in all one meeting, so we take them in pieces. And at yesterday's meeting, we had an opportunity, in a previous meeting, we talked with DSS about homelessness and their policies and so on around that, so we got to know about that. And in yesterday's meeting, we had a sort of a status report and a little bit of a discussion on adult protective services and children's services. Certainly there's more information we can have, and I'm sure we'll be looking at another section of DSS at some point. Some very interesting facts to share, or numbers rather, to share from DSS. Patricia Carey, our Commissioner of Social Services, let us know that, I just want to share. Both the Adult Protective Services and Children's Services are governed by the Office of Children and Family Services of New York State. Children's Services deal primarily with child welfare, CPS, and foster care prevention. She shared with us that as of July, I'm trying to look at the dates, of 2016, CPS referrals, there were 761 hotline reports, and that was up to July of this year. But in 2015, we had over 1,200 hotline reports. Many of those reports have issues of substance abuse alleged in them. And this year, 193 of them. And in 2015, 263 of them had allegations of parental substance abuse.
this all tied in with some of the conversations we've been having around substance abuse issues. They average about 105 hotline cases a month that they deal with. That was in 2015, and in 2016, now I don't remember, 104 average thus far. Foster preventive care, they're looking at 189 cases thus far in 2016, 288 children in those 189 cases being monitored. Patricia did say that although the numbers seem large, you know, 761 hotline numbers, that generally the number of indicated reports, those that come back like, you know, something is going on, are much smaller. But they do, you know, take steps to follow up, and staff is trained in sort of knowing what to listen for, what to look for, what are the questions to ask, so they know if this is something that requires more intervention, more follow-up, reporting to the state, et cetera. So that was some of the information she shared with us. The Adult Protective Services in 2015, we had 252 referrals for Adult Protective Services that came into the department, and currently in 2016, there are 210. So all of 2015, 252 through July of 2016, we're already at 210. So that was DSS. I'm giving you the synopsis, like I said. We did also have a discussion about the evaluation at COFA did on the new PERS system. You know, they had the old system, they upgraded, we had passed a resolution allowing for them to spend some money and upgrade. The new system includes GPS in case of, you know, older adults who might wander, get lost, etc. They are much smaller, and not only are there the necklaces, there's also sort of wrist bracelets that one can use. And some of them are equipped in with technology that allows, and I think we're, I don't think we have those either, we have eight of them, that allows for if someone falls, for example, and they are not able to press the button, that after a while the unit itself would have detected that you have fallen, and the unit will make that call. It will send out the signal. So right now we only have eight of those units available to our residents here in the county. I thought that was extremely, extremely wonderful, because sometimes, you know, our older adults fall and just can't get around to pressing that button. So we're moving to a place where the technology in them is very smart and much more supportive. And so they had an evaluation, you know, talked about, you know, how people like units, how they're being used, et cetera. And some of our committee members are interested in really finding out, are people really using them the way they should be used? And so we're going to be asking, you know, Lisa will try to get some more answers, if people will answer the question. You know, I have a unit, and to ask you, do you use it? Some people may not want to say, no, I don't. So they'll figure out a way to get those answers. So that's another thing we wanted to share with you. And then we spent a lot of time on our rollovers, our budget adjustments that people are asking for. We have three departments that came before us asking for use of rollover funds: the Office for the Aging, the Office of Human Rights, and the County Youth Services Department. We had a number of questions for them, and we were able to get an even more in-depth conversation with Karen Beer, the director of the Office of Human Rights, you know, explaining to us some of how the office works in terms of enforcement versus education. We hope within the next couple of months, since Human Rights reports to us, to be able to have the office come in, have Karen and her staff come in, and we do a little bit more of a review. This was just for rollover, but we did get quite an in-depth discussion, a little bit of a discussion around some of it. Karen also talked about one of the things she's asking for is fair housing testing, to use some of her rollover money for that. She shared last year having done 30 tests. You know, those are two testers each. And next year she's hoping to do 15 around the issue of fair housing. This is where professional trained testers go out in a pair and try to apply for housing, whatever it is, respond to ads for housing, and see if there's any kind of difference in how they're treated when they go there, or people showing up and, you know, Dan shows up with his cats and all of a sudden cats are not allowed, although the ad doesn't say that. So there are a number of things. So she hopes to for her office to do some more testing for that. And that is the gist of what we have. We do hope to have Tammy Baker, who is the outreach worker that the county and city went in to pay to support, come at a future date to talk with us some more about, you know, how the services have been working. She's seeing, you know, any sort of difference being made to some of the clientele industries that we were trying to reach. That is it, unless committee members have anything else they'd like to add.
We're really busy. Questions?
We are busy on HHS.
Jim.
Loveland, I listened with interest in your conversation about the Office of Human Rights. Is there any opportunity, do you believe, in the future that there might be an annual report coming out of that office?
We can ask that of the director. We used to every year get a report on number of cases. So we get a sense of what's happening in our county around human rights issues. And so we can request of that. So when our when that office comes up, that department comes up for just an overview or review of how things have been going as we've been doing with everyone else, we will request that. And they perhaps will bring something with them at that point.
Thank
as
you.
Well. I can ask that.
Anything else? Leslin, I think you have a couple of resolutions.
Yes, I do. No, I only have one, I think. And it has to do with
I'm sorry, I'm flipped back to the consent agenda. Excuse me.
No, I only have one. That's Resolution I, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds for 2015, i.e. rollover, and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to Health and Human Services Committee, ID 6522. And I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dooley.
And if I may just really quickly, you have it on page 30 of your package page. It will tell you exactly what those departments are asking for the monies for. I just want to point out that youth services in particular, this has to do with the state no longer providing funds to the Municipal Youth Bureau, that is the Ithaca City Youth Bureau, for administrative costs for programs that they used to get funding from the state for. That it came through our county, and the county will then disseminate those funds to the Municipal Youth Bureau. Now, those funds are still coming minus administrative costs. So that's what that $10,000 is, and what Amy is asking. Did I say the right name?
No.
Amy is asking for is for this money just, you know, sort of a transition year so that the Ithaca Youth Bureau will know, you know, you have to start making plans to figure out where you're getting that administrative monies from because it's not coming anymore. And that's what this is doing, just that by year to allow for them to plan for recouping those funds elsewhere.
Carol?
So this is a more general question, probably for Joe. It seems like we had greater level of discussion in committee about
the rollover, probably because we're already involved in our budget process. It seems like it's a little bit later in the year than they all these rollover requests usually come to us. When we do these, does the funding then need to be spent in 2016, or else it becomes rollover and we have to do it all over again for 2017?
Yes, this is money for 2016. If it's not spent or encumbered, then you're exactly right. It would end up going into the fund balance. It would remain with that department as a part of their rollover reserve, their dedicated rollover. But yes, it would okay. Go back into the bank.
As per a rollover policy.
Thank you.
Okay, are we ready to vote on this? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm told a short form roll call.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Does anyone wish to be recorded as a no? That's adopted. Unanimous. Okay. Anything else, Leslie?
No, that is it.
All right. Then let's go to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. David McKenna is the chair.
Thank you, Mike. F&I has not met since the last legislature meeting, but we do have one resolution. Resolution J6523 is document ID. Budget adjustment and appropriation of unspent funds from 2015 and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. And I so move.
Seconded by Glenn. Discussion. Short form roll call. I got that one.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Anyone wish to be recorded as no? That's unanimous.
That concludes my report.
Any questions for David? Transportation Committee, we met and discussed how we can go forward with a transportation study of our state highways, particularly Route 13. We talked about Route 96 and also 79 in particular. We will be looking for some help from Fernando de Aragon, our MPO director, who will be talking with the staff at New York State Department of Transportation, Region 3. And we'll also be talking with some of our elected representatives about trying to obtain some funding for this study. Anna.
A quick question. I know that there was a lot of research and input made by the group Form Ithaca about the city section of Route 13. Have you brought them in to talk about or present or show any of their research and their presentation proposal?
No, we have not. I'm thinking maybe it's a little premature for that, although I certainly think that they would be an important group to talk to.
Great. I look forward to that.
Back to Government Operations Committee. Dan Klein is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We still had one resolution to get to, which is Resolution L, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds from 2015 and prior years to various accounts of departments that report to the Government Operations Committee.
Is there a second? Seconded by Anna. Discussion? Ready to vote? Leslie?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if... how one I might be able to ask for those to be separated so I can vote on them individually. There's just one that I, is there a way for that to happen?
You can move to separate that one item out.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to separate out, I lost my page now, County Administration.
Is there a second for the move to separate? Seconded by Will. Is there any discussion on that motion? All in favor of the motion to separate, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Okay, so now we'll vote on two separate resolutions. We'll vote on the primary motion first that does not include that item.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Short form roll call.
What package page number?
Package page 56.
So this vote is on the...
You have
everything
a separate...
Everything but that, yep. We'll do her second.
You have a separate unit.
It's page 72 you want to separate out, is that right?
56. Huh? I'm on package page 56 in my thing.
72 is administration.
The one you want to separate out is administration.
Yes.
That's on...
County administration.
Page 72.
Yes.
Are we all clear?
Yep.
All right. So we're short form on the all the other approvals.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Does anyone wish to be recorded as no? Then that's approved. Let's go to the separated out. There'll be a short form roll call on that one.
Well, wait. Can I ask why?
I just want to vote no.
Well, do you want to make a case?
No, I don't want to make a case, right? I just want to vote no. We had this discussion in executive session, and okay. I'm just interested in voting no.
Go ahead.
Mr. Dennis?
I'm a yes vote.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Does anyone wish to be recorded as no? We have one no. Leslie. That is adopted.
Our committee next meets on October 5th at 3:30 in this room. That's my report.
Any other questions for Dan? Let's go to Dooley Kiefer for the Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality Committee. She's the vice chair.
Yeah. Well, TDEC meets tomorrow. It has a really light agenda. It will hear the annual reports from the WRC and the EMC. And I think it has a housing resolution, but I don't remember. So it should be a relatively quick meeting.
Annual reports?
Discussion or questions of Dooley?
No. I pulled off.
Yeah, we'll get that next.
Okay.
Okay, then, Dooley, there is one resolution off consent. It's Resolution F. Could you move that
resolution
for us?
Resolution which? I'm sorry.
F?
F.
As yes. In Frank?
It's the housing.
Yes.
Well, I just have to abstain from it. That's all.
I'm looking for it so I can move it. So I'd like to move Resolution F, Document 6514, Authorization to Increase the Use of Program Income Funds to Continue the Home Ownership Program. I move it.
Is there a second? Seconded by Anna. Any further discussion? Carol?
I just need to abstain from it. Permission
right,
to.
We'll allow you to abstain.
Thank you.
Ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? One abstention. That passes. Thank you, Dooley. Can you continue right along with charter review?
Sure. Charter review has finished its review. Yay. And we Yay. Will be meeting on the 27th of this month at, I think it's 3:30. At 3, thank you, to discuss how to summarize the important points and let the public know as well as our colleagues know, and to set a date for a public hearing on a local law, hopefully to adopt the changes. I think that's the main order of business for our meeting.
Dooley, could you mention how this group is going to be informed of what we're doing as far as the text?
Our legislature clerk will be presenting a clean copy, and a red line copy will be available also. I don't remember if it's Ms. Colbert's intention to put a paper clean copy or if everything's going to be online. I don't remember.
Okay.
I anticipate distributing the clean version, and then upon request, the highlighted version can be printed and made available.
So it would be a paper version distributed initially?
With the clean version, yes.
Thank you, Kathy.
And we're not rushing to adopt this. We're going to have, about a month for you to look at this thing. Is that right?
Approximately, yes.
Any questions for Dooley? Go to Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis is the chair.
Thank you. Our next meeting is Thursday evening at 5:30 right here. And that concludes my report.
Questions for Jim? Thank you, Jim. Jail Study Committee, Rich John is the chair.
We had our inaugural meeting last week, and we reviewed the charter, or the charge, rather. Sorry, charter's in my head. And the draft RFP, Joe has already discussed with you. And we're moving ahead. I think our next meeting we're going to try to hear further comment from the head of the jail and probation and the CJATI on the condition of the jail and the status of all the ATI programs that we're involved with. But we're also going to consider who we would like to hear from as a committee. Anna, did I forget anything?
Just the summary of Scott's presentation.
We did hear from Judge Scott Miller, who was quite eloquent in talking about the challenges he faces in deciding whether to put somebody in the jail, and one of his major considerations is whether they're a real risk to themselves because of drug use. That's pretty sad. That's my report.
Questions for any other questions for Rich? Thank you, Rich. Leslin, back to you for Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to start out this my report. We haven't had a meeting, but we will be meeting next Wednesday, and thanks to Paula and her doggone enthusiasm, a whole big part of her agenda is out with MBEs and WBEs because it's now already in her policy. So we were going to be talking about that as one of that, but we're thankful that it is in our new non-discrimination policy. I do want to say a great big thank you to you and others for acknowledging our employees who you did for their years of service to the county earlier this evening. One of the things that Workforce Diversity and Inclusion has been drumming for years is employee recognition. And something as simple as doing that, I can see people's faces, and I'm sure you all could, to just know that they're being recognized for the service they put in. They don't have to wait until, you know, it's 25 years to be recognized. So that was an extremely, extremely important gesture, and I look forward to it continuing because it means well to all our employees, and we push for that. And I also want to give a great big thank you to the personnel department because I think they're tired of listening to me say, where are we with the employee recognition program? What's going on? So I'm thankful to see that. So, again, thank you all. Our reading and discussion program is coming up. The fall session is coming up. Wednesdays, October 26th, November 2nd, 9th, and the 16th, 3:30 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They will be held this time at the Emergency Response Facility at 92 Brown Road. The topic for this fall session is the language of diversity, which is a very intriguing topic. Here are some things that it says that we will do, and we try to unpack the language of diversity, including common terminology and commonly misused phrases that can confuse us, embarrass us, or divide us. The language of diversity is an evolving one that requires awareness and understanding. When it comes to diversity language, can be a bridge for building relationship. It's very, very important, or a tool for creating and maintaining divisions across differences. We like the first part, building relationships. Last year, we engaged in, or 2 years ago, actually, we engaged in a wonderful employee climate, a workplace climate survey,
and, you know, just having those cross-department relationships were extremely important. And sometimes people don't know how to talk to each other because they haven't had that opportunity to do so. Here's an opportunity around just diversity and inclusion to be able to do that. Our session facilitator is once again Colonel Woodson. Colonel is a young man who is currently working at Cornell. He's backed by popular demand. Our employees who participated the last time really enjoyed his facilitation. And so, he's back again. So if you are able to, we are certainly encouraging employees at all levels as well as our elected representatives here around the table to please, please, please participate. We cannot emphasize enough how important it is to be a part of workshops, trainings, discussions, dialogues that have to do with diversity and inclusion. And here's an opportunity that is not risky. It's wonderful dialogue, and it takes all forms. It's not a book club, so no, you don't have to necessarily be reading a book all the time, but it takes the form of videos or TED Talks, sometimes some articles to read, and come prepared to just talk and share experiences and build relationships. So we do want to encourage you, all of you watching and all of you around the table, to sign up. Registration begins October 5th, which is coming up pretty soon. So, and as mentioned earlier by Anna, the new Jim Crow community read. Again, I want to encourage all of us to participate in the community read of this book. This is a real glaring representation or discussion, I would say, of our criminal justice system and some of the biases attached to it and some of the things that end up having mass incarceration, particularly of people of color and young people of color. As it says, the subtitle to the book, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. So I do encourage everyone to please read it and participate in the community discussions that will be happening on that. We are certainly very supportive at WDIC of this program, and thanks to Roberta Wallet, a community member whose brainchild this was, and her tenacity to make it happen. She certainly was tenacious in saying, you know, we've got to do this. This is getting out of hand. From a WDIC standpoint, it's unfortunate some of the things that we're hearing in the news from people who are running for office locally, statewide, nationally, that perpetuate ugliness for all of us, not just for any one group, but for all of us. So we want to be, you know, change leaders in this county. We've always been sort of forward thinking and forward moving, but change leaders in changing the diversity and inclusion conversation one little municipality at a time. And if Tompkins County can be a leader and can do it, if we can model Seattle and other places, we can do it. And we've been making strides towards that. So thank you all very much. Again, we will meet next Wednesday, 3:30 in the old jail. And there are other things we will be talking about other than MBEs and WBEs. So thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Jim?
I want to call attention to something I learned on the Old Guy Facebook network, but it is our colleague Leslie McBean Claiborne's birthday today. So I want to let you know.
Happy birthday, Leslie.
Thank you, and I'm a proud half a century.
And since you gave such a nice report, we won't see.
And she was supposed to be at dinner an hour and a half ago, but, you know.
I am. But I love you all too much, so there.
Oh, wow. All right, can we move to the minutes of the previous meetings? September 6th. Moved by Rich, seconded by Mike. Discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? One opposed. And we have a special meeting on September 12th. Someone want to move that?
Move.
Leslin, seconded by Glenn. All in favor? Any opposed? That's unanimous. Unfinished business. One thing I wanted to mention, and I'm as guilty as everybody, but we listening from up here, I was thinking about it tonight, we all need to try to, when we talk about various agencies and things that we're doing and using the acronyms, to try to say what it stands for when we're talking about it, so the folks at home watching TV get a little indication of what that is, because they may not know the acronyms.
Good idea.
You might want to cut those two people out of.
Well, because they're in different houses, they can't ask each other, you know. Carol?
Some of us have more active constituents. Unfinished business, are the direct reports, have we scheduled any of our sessions on that?
On the direct,
disappeared.
Jim? Did we lose Jim?
Jim, okay, I guess
there's a question for you, Jim, on unfinished business.
Is there a date yet for the direct reports, any of the sessions?
Okay, anything else? I take a motion to adjourn?
Yeah.
By Anna, seconded by Will. All in favor? Opposed? Carried. Thank you to everybody. Thank